Welcome, welcome, welcome to the first episode of our new summer edition of Being Jewish that I'm calling 30 Minute Mensches. Same vibe, same tribe, shorter episodes. Because it's summer and I want to hang out with my kids. But also because I want to use the opportunity of this more concentrated format to bring you some really unique and diverse humans doing fascinating and important work that you don't always get to hear about. This season, we've got Jewish animators, energy healers, rappers, Black Jews, crypto Jews, trans Jews, Orthodox Jews, Lebanese Christians, Rwandans, Israelis, and many, many more. And to kick us off, I've got a real heavyweight with me for today's premiere. Born in Jerusalem, raised in Canada, she's currently serving as Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, fighting with bigots and educating useful idiots so we don't have to. She is a former member of the Knesset, a legal scholar, and our inaugural 30-Minute Mensch. Please welcome to the show, Michal Kotler-Wunsch.
Thank you for having me.
You are the special envoy for combating anti-Semitism. How's that going? Because things don't look great from where I'm sitting.
So I'll tell you, don't I? You know, I get that question a lot. You can imagine I was appointed. I was appointed 3 weeks before October the 7th, actually.
Lucky you.
You know, somebody wished me condolences on my appointment to the role. And in fact, in many, many ways, the fact that this role needs to exist, not only in the state of Israel, but in about 35 countries, is devastating. And it is going in a way that actually, for me, is a call to action every single day, reminding me that about 2,500 years ago or so, it was actually Mordechai who said to Esther that last time that in ancient Persia there was an attempt to annihilate the Jewish people, our people, if you will be silent now, salvation will come to our people, and you and your father's home may disappear, and who knows if it's not for this moment that you've arrived. So that has been the everyday call to action, in fact, for the last 21 months.
We've talked about that on the show, that this is our Queen Esther moment. It's clear you're stepping up into it. I'm curious if you could take us behind the scenes of this role. Like, what have you been charged to do specifically? And are there deliverables? Like, do you have concrete goals and metrics? And if so, what's the strategy that you're using to try to achieve those goals?
Anti-Semitism is just the manifestation of what is a raging eighth front, because we've been speaking certainly in Israel about seven fronts of war that were waged on the state of Israel on and since October 7th, 2023. The eighth front of war is the unconventional war for public opinion, as I call it. And I believe that anti-Semitism is very much a manifestation and a tool of that eighth front. So that would be my number one mandate, to be able to identify and combat that, making sure that we actually hone and harness the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. The second, no less important sort of part of this role is working with my counterparts around the world, but also with university presidents, legislators, mayors, police chiefs, communities around the world that are absolutely committed to combating all forms of hate, anti-Semitism included, but don't necessarily understand how it is that we identify this strain of anti-Semitism that is, and that has proven to be, anti-Zionism.
Right.
And the third is actually, ironically or not, making accessible this fight or this front of war to Israelis. Because maybe it might not make sense to all of your listeners or viewers, but Israelis, actually, as we are embroiled in the seven fronts of, I'll call it conventional war, that has been raging for decades, are not as mindful of this manifestation of this eighth front of war. And it's no less important to make accessible to Israelis as well.
So I want to dig into a couple of those things. So let's start with what you raised as point two, is working with all these different leaders politically and in law enforcement and universities. How does that process unfold? Are you reaching out to people? Are people reaching out to the government? Like, what does that look like?
So my first emergency trip was actually, you know, devastatingly in the middle of our closest friend's son's Shiva. Nice. I left just about 10 days after October the 7th. Yeah. And the first emergency trip to the United States was actually to reach out to the legislators, including the second gentleman, including all of those that were mandated with actually the U.S. National strategy for combating anti-Semitism and rolling that out and implementing that both federally and in the various states. And of course, the university presidents, where it could have and should have been anticipated that if there was not an unequivocal condemnation of the atrocities, the war crimes, the crimes against humanity that we witnessed in the October 7th attack of barbarism on civilization. And it was clear, certainly to those of us that have been at the front lines of tracking the mutation of anti-Semitism and the hijacking and weaponization of international law and its institutions and human rights, the secular religion of our times, for the demonization, delegitimization, application of double standards towards the state of Israel. So what happened on university campuses over the last few decades was clear that if it was not addressed properly, immediately by university presidents with an unequivocal condemnation of the October 7 massacre, what we would see is the tsunami of anti-Semitism. Then it has been very much of a reactive role. From my perspective, when I entered the role 3 weeks before October the 7th, the goal was to create a national strategy for combating anti-Semitism, which in Israel's case, as the nation state of the Jewish people, a prototypical indigenous people that returned to our ancestral homeland after thousands of years of exile and persecution, needs to have an international component to it.
What you're alluding to is the fact that Israelis don't live in a minority as Jews. They live in a majority. So they don't walk down the street wondering what somebody's thinking about them with their kippah on. So if you could speak to, I guess, the level of awareness and sort of what you've been hearing and seeing from your fellow countrymen as this has unfolded.
Why would Israelis ever experience what it is like to be a minority? Actually, in the relationship between Israel and global Jewry, that is a huge component of what global Jewry is able to teach Israelis, right? The understanding that wherever we live in the world, whether it's in Argentina, in Canada, in the United States, or anywhere else in the world, when we are a minority, we understand things differently as a people. And the importance of making that accessible to Israelis actually began for me, as somebody who grew up in Canada, you mentioned, began for me as a legislator, as a member of Israel's Knesset. The understanding that that is an important understanding for Israelis when we make decisions. For me, anti-Semitism, in the words of the late Rabbi Sacks, is the most reliable sign of a major threat to humanity, freedom, and the dignity of difference. We can drill down on why that is so. But for the state of Israel, more than any other country, the rise or tsunami, or what I'll describe as happening now, whether at a music festival in England or on the streets of New York City with a mayoral candidate that differentiates between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, the understanding that it's the normalization of anti-Semitism that we need to be cognizant of as a major threat or as a reliable sign of a major threat to freedom and humanity and the dignity of difference.
So you mentioned, you know, current events kind of stuff like the concert in Glastonbury. So take me through, like, in your role, something like that happens. You've also said, you know, your role has had to be somewhat reactionary. What do you do when that happens? Are you reaching out to people in the UK? Are you just trying to get on the news? Like, what's the strategy?
The first order of business is that the embassy on the ground will reach out to me and sort of not only be able to take the interviews that are relevant with media that need to be made aware of the imperative to not just call out what it is that was absolutely a death call. Death to the IDF is essentially not just the call for the death of all Israelis, because there's mandatory service in the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, but of course mainstreams anti-Semitism around the world. And that is, in fact, what has happened since.
Michal, I want to drill down on the death to the IDF thing, because obviously there are some people who know full well what they're doing. But I think a lot of people, the problem is that they think of the IDF essentially as you and I would think of Nazis. They've been taught that this is a supremacist, murderous, genocidal, you know, villain. And so in their minds, they're chanting, you know, death to the Nazis, which I can understand if that's your understanding. I also would say, you know, no one ever has chanted death to anybody at a music festival before. So you've got the double standard already is built in there. That's no one would ever do that to anybody in any other circumstance ever. But how do we sort of reconcile that misunderstanding? And instead of making everybody there feel like we think you're all anti-Semitic, hateful, you know, villains, that we're missing each other. Like there's a missing piece of this connection happening where if these people understood the issue, they might go, oh, I see why I shouldn't be chanting that, or I see what I'm not getting here, or whatever the case may be.
So you're 100% right. Here's the devastating thing, Jonah. If in fact I'm right, that it's human rights, the secular religion of our times, that has been hijacked and appropriated. And you understand that anti-Semitism has actually mutated, creating new viral strains over the thousands of years of its existence by latching onto the guiding social construct of each time, right? Religion, science, and the secular religion of our times, human rights. If I'm right, that in fact it is human rights that have been hijacked and appropriated in the institutions of the UN and its agencies and its principles, so that I'll give an example. After a series of conventional wars from 1948, the moment of our return to our ancestral homeland, if you will, to 1973, a series of conventional wars openly declared with intent to annihilate the state of Israel. In 1975, the UN itself, this sort of institution created to uphold, promote, and protect an international rules-based order post-World War II, and you said a key word, equally and consistently to all, because double standards in the application of any principle of any rule basically renders it useless. The paper that it's written on is not worth anything.
Right.
The understanding that from 1975 on, what we have seen is the hijacking and weaponization of that international rules-based order, of its institutions, of its principles. So I begin with 1975. The Zionism is racism, UN resolution, passed in the UN, Soviet propaganda was alive and well before that, passed in the UN, alive and well in the name of 2025 progress on every university campus, online, on the streets, absolutely makes your understanding of what it is that those people chanting death, death to the IDF, assuming that the state of Israel is not only based on this Zionism is racism, but then in a post-2001 Durban conference against racism, Durban, South Africa, this conference, UN conference against racism, that turns into an anti-Semitic hate fest that then posits that the state of Israel is an apartheid state. And in the most Orwellian inversion of fact and law and morality, the accusation of the state of Israel of genocide in the aftermath of the October 7 massacre. You have to be very clear. Genocide termed by Raphael Lemkin, whose entire family was annihilated in Auschwitz, to describe the atrocities of the Holocaust. Too terrible to imagine, but not too terrible to have happened. Genocide alongside crimes against humanity coined, and then becoming the infrastructure for the Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, used to accuse the state of Israel, seating it on the dock of the accused, if you will, in the International Court of Justice. Dreyfus seated on the dock of the accused, accusing it of genocide, the worst crime you could possibly commit, even as the state of Israel, the Jew among nations, intended to be an equal member in the family of nations, but barred from being precisely that after decades of demonization, delegitimization, application of double standards by those very institutions, then you can understand why the crowds would not only listen to, but echo the chant of death, death to the IDF. We have to be clear, the Israel Defense Force, not the Israel Attack Force, the Israel Defense Force that is actually necessary because there we live in, if you just zoom out for a moment, a geography of neighbors that are intent to annihilate the state of Israel, including the genocidal criminal Islamic regime in Iran and all of its terror proxies over the last 21 months, as we have clearly seen impoverishing the people of Iran for 46 years to build nuclear and ballistic capabilities that we have just experienced in the last 12 days. And of course, since October 7th in its ring of fire that it built around Israel. But what we have to make very clear, and for me, that's the most important, is that this is not just about the Jewish nation state. If I am right that the international rules-based order and the human rights infrastructure, including all of the organizations, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and many others, that were mandated and entrusted to uphold, promote, and protect that international rules-based order equally and consistently. If that infrastructure collapses, it will fail to protect everybody.
What can realistically be done when you've got these trusted international pillars of the rule of order that have been, you know, infected from within? And we, as Jews, are this very small voice. It sounds like we're going, hey, everybody's an anti-Semite, which is very easy to be like, that's ridiculous. Is the answer to try to heal the virus? Is the answer to get new institutions and abandon ship on the broken ones? What do you think can actually be done?
I think that there's a combination of efforts that need to be made. And the first thing that I want to say to anybody who is watching us is, you are all boots on the ground of this eighth front. What I have just described is an eighth front of war in which every single individual has a role to play, whether it's at work, whether it's at home, whether it's in educational institutions, in academia, in legislature, wherever it is. The understanding that, and I have to be very sort of open about this, 2025 is not 1945. It's possibly the first time in thousands of years of Jewish history that we can actually make good on Golda Meir's understanding that the world loves us when we're to be pitied. The world hates a Jew who hits back. The state of Israel is the Jew that can hit back after thousands of years of Jewish history. But that means we have an additional role to play now that we can hit back. And there's only about 16 million of us in the entire world. It's not that many. But we have friends and we have allies that understand that this is not just about us. I have to be very clear, as all other forms of hatred and bigotry, anti-Semitism is not a problem of Jews. It's a problem of anti-Semites and of the places and spaces that allow them to fester, to spread, to infect with this lethal, ever-mutating hate. And everywhere that I've been in these 21 months, and I'm being around the world, Joan, I have to tell you, there is a moderate majority public out there that understands that something has gone very wrong. If the Human Rights Council in the UN is populated with the most egregious violators of human rights, by the way, the Islamic regime in Iran included, then that is not about us. But what I often say is we are at this moment of history where, you know, I spoke about the three Ds, demonization, delegitimization, the application of double standards. That is the mechanism that enables the mutation of anti-Semitism. That's a part of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition. But I often speak of the three Rs because in 2025, that is not 1945, I don't want hate defining me. I don't want, in the words of the, you know, late Rabbi Soloveitchik, only the destiny of fate defining who we are as a people. It's the covenant of destiny that can define us. And for that, I speak about the three R's. And they are to remember and to reclaim and to renew. And that's not just about Jews. To remember the Jewish story is a critical piece that I think that perhaps we have forgotten or we took for granted that we remember. Yeah. Remembering the Jewish story is going to be critical to the day after, if you will, and how it is that we rise from what it is that we've experienced in these 21 months. And God willing, with the return of the 50 human beings that continue to be held in the terror tunnels and dungeons of Hamas. But remembering the Jewish story means that we say, we know that anti-Semitism didn't begin in 1933 and didn't die in Auschwitz. But neither does the Jewish story. We remember the Jewish story. We started our conversation with Esther. That's about 2,500 years ago or so. Remembering our story is something that I think that we have an opportunity to do and to retell our story once we remember it. To reclaim what it is that's been appropriated, not just from us. I mentioned the word indigeneity. I mentioned the word Zionist. Look, I speak about this often. You know, when I say anti-Zionism is the new modern mainstream strain of anti-Semitism, Zionism didn't sort of, you know, fall from the sky. Zionism is anchored in thousands of years of yearning and prayer and longing to return to Zion. The majority of Jews around the world, self-identifying Zionists, and many non-Jews around the world who believe in Israel's right to exist self-identify as Zionist. That means that the ability to reclaim what's being appropriated and also what's being appropriated in terms of that international rules-based order and human rights, because genocide has meaning. I said that definition was appropriated, including by Amnesty International, literally redefining it on, I don't know, page 101, I believe, of about a 300-page report, literally redefining. And so does racism that Zionism is equated to. And so does apartheid, and Israel has its problems. But I'm old enough to remember precisely what apartheid was, and Israel is not an apartheid state.
So, Michal, what I want to do now is I want to leave our audience with some takeaways that they can use and hold on to. So I'm going to give you a couple of these sort of basic common things that I hear and see, and have you help me and help our audience know how to respond to them. The first one, and something you said earlier made me think of it, is the notion that, of course, anti-Semitism is rising right now. The IDF is you know, murdering thousands of innocent people. And once that goes away, the anti-Semitism is going to go away. But it makes sense that it would be happening because of what's going on. How do you respond to that?
The IDF is defending the state of Israel. What is murdering those thousands of people, if there are thousands of people being murdered that are in fact innocent, and we don't know that because we have Hamas evidence, that's the Gaza Health Ministry, that's Hamas. That's akin to quoting Nazi Germany and the statistics that they may have published during World War II. But the understanding that the IDF is actually doing everything that it can to mitigate the damage to innocent civilians, as urban war specialists will tell us. And the only entities that we should be holding to account is actually the genocidal terror organization, Hamas included, but also the Houthis, also the Hezbollah, all proxies of the Islamic regime in Iran that intentionally embedded amongst civilians for whom human tragedy is the strategy, that built hundreds of kilometers of terror tunnels and dungeons below hospitals, schools, homes, mosques, with international humanitarian aid, knowing precisely that they were identifying where international laws of war would actually leave the state of Israel that respects the laws of war at a complete loss with being able to defend its own civilians, as they perpetrated not only October the 7th, but the 21 months of continued attacks. And very few people speak about the thousands of rockets, ballistic missiles, UAVs that have intentionally targeted Israel's civilians.
Even though what you just said might make sense to me in my brain, in my heart, I just can't ignore the horrible images that I'm seeing. And it seems like it's Israel's fault. And so, of course, I'm mad at Israel, so I can be mad at Jews wherever I live.
That in and of itself is anti-Semitism, right? The fact that there is a Jew living in, I don't know, Massachusetts or Montreal or Sydney, Australia, that is being targeted for their identity because of, let's say that Israel is doing what it is accused of doing. What does that have anything to do with that Jew living across the ocean? Absolutely nothing. That is something that we have to be very clear on. There is never, ever a justification. That would be akin to attacking somebody who moved to the United States from France because of something that France is doing. That never happens. And you said before that double standard is something that we have to be able to call out, meaning including to university presidents. That I would say, I don't know if you remember, but that hearing in Congress where it depended on context, if calling for the genocide of Jews violated codes of conduct of university, would it depend on context if it was any other minority group for whom we called for the genocide of? The answer is no. So right. It is in this case. Now, the tragedy, the human tragedy, that those that genuinely care for Palestinians, and by the way, I have to say that the authenticity of the concern seems to fade every time that there is footage of hundreds and thousands of hours of the same Hamas, a genocidal terror organization, again, for whom human tragedy is the strategy, that use their own people as human shields, as sacrifices, as trading cards. The understanding that if you care for human rights of Palestinians, you would be protesting to free Gaza from Hamas. And if you care for the people of Lebanon, you would be protesting to free Lebanon from the Hezbollah. And if you cared for the people of Yemen, you would be protesting to free Yemen from the Houthis. And if you cared for the people of Iran, and on this we have to be so clear, because the people of Iran have risen up again and again with unbelievable courage to the Islamic regime in Iran that does the very same things as we speak now, arresting and executing the people of Iran. Now, if we take this back just about 80 years and we say, surely there were innocent Germans that were killed. But did that mean that the Allies could let the Nazis appease the Nazis and allow them to continue taking over the world with a genocidal ideology? If that is what we are saying, then we are, you know, to quote Churchill, we have the choice between dishonor and war. We may choose dishonor, but we will have war because genocidal terror can't be appeased. And that is something that we have to be very clear on, including on mainstream media. That then on, you know, the front page of the New York Times publishes not 11 days after October the 7th, what Hamas has actually given them as data that the state of Israel allegedly bombs a hospital, only to weeks later say, oops, that was an errant rocket from Palestinian Islamic Jihad, yet another proxy of the criminal Islamic regime in Iran. We live in a social media era. The way that we consume information has to radically change because the way that it comes to us has radically changed, meaning there are really negative players that are utilizing social media to do precisely what social media does. We all understand the algorithm. It's not the boogeyman. It's a business model, polarizing and fragmentizing. We know that Iran, we know that China, we know that Russia, and we know that, you know, the understanding of using that algorithm to actually disseminate complete disinformation and misinformation. And by the time, if in the past we used to say that a lie makes its way around the world before the truth straps its boots on, that was well before social media, digital spaces, and certainly AI.
We are reaching the end of our time together, so I would love for you to leave us with some silver lining, some data or observation, something that gives you hope in this never-ending fight.
You know, I say very often, hope is what carried the Jewish people for thousands of years of our existence. Hope is our national anthem, Hatikva. And hope is what carries us every single day as we fight for our existence here and around the world. But, you know, the late Rabbi Sacks differentiated between hope and optimism. And he said the following. He said, optimism is the belief that everything will be okay. But hope is the belief that together we can make it okay. So in that sense, optimism is a very passive virtue and hope is a very active one. And it takes not very much courage to be an optimist, but a great deal of courage to have hope. And I have met Jonah over the last 21 months and way before that, not only here in Israel, this incredible generation of heroes that are not only willing to take action, but are doing so with courage, knowing that courage is contagious. But I have met their counterparts around the world. And that gives me a great deal of hope, whether they are in the trenches at the university campuses or on the streets or online or right here in Israel on the other seven fronts of war. I have a great deal of hope for our people. And I know that we have survived precisely these kinds of challenges without what we have today, which is sovereignty, which is a state of Israel, which is an IDF in which 45% of us live and which the rest of us live in the rest of the world in relative safety and security with the ability to speak up and to stand up and to fight back and to hold our heads up high and know that Am Yisrael Chai, that we will prevail.
Michal, thank you so much for the tireless work you do and for being here with me today to kick off our series. It's been a privilege and a pleasure.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right, she's a mensch. It's been 30 minutes. I'm Jonah Platt. I'll see you all next time.